Want to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step three, tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step four, create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, how you doing, everybody? Today we're talking one of the coolest car brands around. You know them, you love them. Ferrari loves to hate them. It's the one and only Lamborghini. We're gonna find out how this company started. How did Ferruccio Lamborghini go from building tractors to building some of the baddest cars on the planet? We're gonna find out. Let's get into it. 1963, Maranello, Italy. Ferruccio Lamborghini, founder of Lamborghini Trattori, is dissatisfied with his Ferrari 250 GT, and he needs Ferrari to know. He can look past the noisy interior and rough ride, but the car's clutch is a thorn in his side. To Ferruccio, this clutch is inferior and has no place being in a top-of-the-line sports coupe. In fact, he's had to bring it to Maranello multiple times to be rebuilt. Ferruccio sits down with Enzo Ferrari with a simple request. Maybe consider redesigning his car's clutch? This does not sit well with Il Commendatore, and the meeting soon erupts into a shouting match. Then, Enzo mutters a few words that would change the future of the Italian sports car industry forever. Stick to making tractors. How did Ferruccio get his start making tractors, then pivot to supercars? Which Lamborghini model was the first to beat a Ferrari? And how did the company survive so many financial disasters? Grab an espresso and buckle up. This week, pass gas on Lamborghini. Welcome back to Pass Gas, everybody. My name is Nolan Sykes, joined by Bart Bidlingmeyer. What's up?
Hey, guys. How you doing?
And Joe Weber.
A spaghetti alla bucatini. Those are two types of spaghetti. What am I saying?
I thought you
spaghetti alla bucatini. Yeah. I tried.
Bucatini's
my favorite.
What you do is you take the spaghetti and you put it inside the bucatini.
See. That's spaghetti alla bucatini.
Yeah.
Wow.
Very high.
Do you know any Italian, Joe?
I know.
I know this one guy, Giuseppe.
I called Joseph, our editor, Giuseppe, and he goes, "That doesn't even mean Joseph." And I go, "Yeah, it does." I know Italian from, I know Italian that's been like, it's like Spanglish, just from my grandma and you know.
Ing-Italian.
But we have a bunch of like little isms that we say in our family, like Gulu Faduzu, which means like ass face. It's basically you take an Italian word and you put a U on the end, okay. And that's like a Sicilian ism. But for the longest time, my great grandma called the bathroom the Bacauzu. And we're like, oh, that just means bathroom in Italian. And then we realized that she was saying back house,
okay,
with an accent. So like outhouse.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. But we say like ajadu is like heartburn. Oh, I got ajadu from the meatballs. We say like, I don't know, there's like, I can't think of them now, but in the moment. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's probably like 40, 50 of them that I say regularly. And Emily's like, "What'd you just say?" Kauzu.
And you, Bart, do you know any Italian?
Just pastas.
What's your favorite pasta, Bart?
I really like bucatini.
Bucatini is awesome.
I really like a pappardelle.
I was going to say that's my second favorite.
Yeah.
Dude, that's such
nice
a good
wide noodle.
Yeah. It's like Italian patsy.
There's also, I think it's something between a fusilli and a bucatini. It's a hollow curved.
Yeah.
Real tight.
Does it have ridges?
There is one. There's so many.
I know.
I do like the one with the ridges, but also there's the one without. And also just an angel hair primavera would be. That's just like very good with a shrimp.
Angel hair is pretty low on my list.
Yeah.
But I
think everything's got the right. You need to use a different sauce and different ingredients with each pasta, I enjoy the freshness and simplicity of an angel hair, where it's especially when you cut it all into and break it up into little pieces before you cook it.
No, no. I think the best noodle for mac and cheese is the corkscrew one. Yep.
With the ridges.
It holds the most sauce.
Yeah. The ridges hold sauce.
Yeah.
That they do. this is not a pasta podcast, though. This is a history podcast. This is where we're talking about the
Pasta gassa.
Ooh.
Okay.
We are talking about Lamborghini today, so maybe we should go around and say what our favorite Lamborghini is.
Yeah. Sounds good.
Countach? Yeah.
Okay.
Because of from what it symbolizes, I know it's not. At the time, it was certainly technologically pretty impressive. Not so much anymore.
Yeah.
But I think, such a cool, and that's, again, that was what was the poster.
Right.
You know, like, wow. And I think everything since then, of course, beautiful, wonderful cars, but they all kind of, they needed that. They needed the Countach.
Absolutely. It's kind of funny how they've been basically the same car for the last 50 years, you know. My favorite is...
Well, I mean, in that way, like the Countach is almost like the 911 of Lamborghini, if you will. Like that's that side profile, that shape, like the mid-engine just philosophy has like trickled all the way down into the, what do they even call it these days? Their flagship.
Oh, Rivuelto?
Rivuelto.
Yeah.
Nice, Joe. You have a really good memory, by the way.
Thanks for random stupid shit. What I meant is like, it's been the same wedge shape with scissor doors and a V10 or a V12.
V12,
For the longest time, and it's just been so good. And then like the biggest jump in technological advancement was all-wheel drive, and that made it so good. So, I think my favorite. Just my heart wants to say the Diablo, but I think the Murcielago with a gated shifter is the best one.
I'm with you on that. When I was like 12 years old, me and my buddy Andrew would be playing Need for Speed Carbon, listening to Dane Cook on CD. And I was like, I want to be a stand-up comedian. Yeah. I want to move to LA. I will get rich and famous, and then I will buy a Lamborghini Murcielago.
Oh, that's fun. So. You're like, this is the part where he humps the stool.
Yeah. I'll hump a stool too. And then get my Lamborghini.
It's as simple as that.
Yeah. So, anyway. But the Murcielago is still my favorite one. I mean,
I remember when you got on stage and you humped that stool and everybody was like, boo.
We've seen it.
Yeah.
But he still got the Murcielago.
I did do stand up like 3 times. That was a lot of fun.
I remember that.
Yeah.
You got a good reaction too.
Yeah. Dude. Yeah. At the Belly Room at the Comedy Store.
Yeah.
You crushed it, dude.
You did.
That was still chasing that high.
That's what it is. You're like, you go out night after night and you're like, I just want that first big laugh.
Let's get into the history of Lamborghini. On April 28th, 1916, Ferruccio Lamborghini was born in a small farming town outside Modena in northern Italy. Ferruccio's parents were grape farmers, which meant he spent his formative years working in the family vineyard, helping grow and harvest grapes for local wineries. But as time went on, Ferruccio became increasingly more interested in machines than grapes. In fact, he would regularly disassemble perfectly functioning farm equipment and put them back together just to see how they worked. As he reflected later in life, quote, "From a very young age, I knew how to fix anything that moved or didn't move." Inspired by his interest in all things auto, 18-year-old Ferruccio chose to study engineering at Fratelli Taddea Technical School near Bologna. He wasn't the most brilliant all-around student, but Ferruccio's passion for experimenting with engines combined with his farm-bred practical thinking skills proved to be more than enough to excel at the most important thing, learning how to build automotive machines. As he finished college, Lamborghini's mechanical talents turned out to be even more useful than he expected. World War II brought with it the desperate need for guys on the ground who could repair broken war machines. Enter Ferruccio, who was drafted into the Royal Italian Air Force and assigned to be a mechanic on the Isle of Rhodes.
Which I didn't understand. That was under, I mean, still under Greek rule, Rhodes. Mm-hmm. It's very close to Turkey.
Is it? Okay. Yeah, because the Axis powers, as some appeasement, the British agreed to let like the Nazis and I guess the Italians take over the Mediterranean to kind of like keep them busy.
Yeah, this is your stuff.
While the you know they were preparing to defend Britain and their allies. Like when I went to Crete, mm-hmm. I took a ride with a taxi driver. He was taking my wife and I to a beach, and he actually showed us a few different options and gave us like a history lesson basically of the island. It was awesome.
That's really cool.
Apostolos was the driver's name. And he explained that, you know, a lot of these Greek isles, like if they weren't under Greek control, like, you know, they kind of have their own national identity.
Yeah.
Like Cretans consider themselves Cretan rather than Greek.
Right.
Greek, Cyprus has Greek Cypriots, but they also have Turkish Cypriots.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So anyway, like long history, like the Nazis were not the first people to occupy these islands. Like a lot of these islands have been occupied by many different Ottomans for them.
Just
the Italians.
Just a bunch of couches everywhere.
Here. Yeah. And the Italians here, in Rhodes. So yeah. Anyway, so Ferruccio Lamborghini stationed on Rhodes mm-hmm. being one of those Italians. During his time in the war, Ferruccio worked on everything from transport trucks to massive generators and often had to scavenge parts and improvise repairs, which only expanded his mechanical knowledge. Even after Mussolini was overthrown and Italy switched sides in 1943 and Ferruccio was taken prisoner by the Nazis, his experience in the shop proved to be incredibly valuable as he avoided the horrors of grueling work camps by being assigned to maintain machinery for the Germans.
I don't really know like the Italian side of World War II as much as I should.
I don't know. Me neither.
But I didn't realize that Mussolini fell like a couple years before the war ended. Or Mussolini was overthrown.
I didn't know that either. Following the end of World War II and his release from captivity, Ferruccio Lamborghini returned home and opened an engineering workshop. Italy was in shambles after the war, and they desperately needed their agricultural industry to get back on track. So Ferruccio decided to return to his farming roots and focus on creating tractors out of old military equipment. Lamborghini Trattori was born. Like a baby.
Oh, nice.
Was born.
Yeah. 2 years later, in 1948, Lamborghini debuted his new machine, the Carioca. This ultra-modern tractor could not only, quote, pull twice as hard at half the size, according to Lamborghini, but also maximize gas mileage thanks to its new fuel atomizer, which started with gas, then switched to a distillate fuel.
I don't know. That just seems like a carb, doesn't it?
But it sounds like it must be mixing maybe ethanol with gasoline. You know, mm-hmm. it's making something before it hits the carb.
Oh.
You know, to, in quotes, atomize it, I think.
Okay.
It's a gimmicky name. I don't have the answer, but that's what it sounds like.
Sounds good to me, Bart.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, a distillate fuel would be ethanol, right? Yeah. By 1949, Lamborghini's 2-, 3-, and 4-cylinder tractors were being used across Italy. Along with their revolutionary power and fuel efficiency, the machines also had interchangeable components, which helped with a variety of farm and construction work. Business boomed for Ferruccio throughout the 1950s, as Lamborghini Trattori became an industrial powerhouse in Italy and the rest of Europe. It was during this run of success when Ferruccio's taste for the finer things led him amassing a collection of the best sports cars of the time. In his garage, he had Alfa Romeos, Lancias, a Mercedes 300 SL. He had 2 Maserati 3500 GTs and a Jaguar E-Type. And of course, a few Ferraris. Lamborghini admired Ferraris, but ever the engineer, he also had a few ideas for how to improve them. In an interview Ferruccio did in 1991, he said, quote, All my Ferraris had clutch problems. When you drove them normally, everything was fine. But when you're going hard, the clutch would slip under acceleration. It just wasn't up to the job. Lamborghini modified his 250 GT extensively. Quote, I bought a bigger clutch from Borg and Beck and had it fitted in the tractor factory workshop. We then discarded Ferrari cylinder heads. I had them replaced by heads of our own design with twin camshafts.
That's nuts.
Then we put the engine back in the 250 GT and fitted it with six horizontally mounted carburetors. Damn.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Whoa.
That's crazy. We would be doing 230, 240 kph, which is about 150 miles an hour, and then we would start to pull away from them. My Ferrari was at least 25 kph faster than theirs thanks to our 4-cam conversion. Good Lord. Lamborghini certainly had solutions to offer. So, in 1963, he drove his 250 GT 30 minutes to Ferrari headquarters to talk to the man himself. From the interview, Lamborghini recalled, quote, the problem with the clutch was never cured, so I decided to talk to Enzo Ferrari. I had to wait for him for a very long time. Ferrari, your car is...
He was making bucatini.
a la spaghetti. Ferrari, your cars are rubbish, I complained. Il Commendatore was furious. Lamborghini, you may be able to drive a tractor, but you will never be able to handle a Ferrari properly. You stick to building tractors. You don't know anything about sports cars.
Oh, my God.
I feel like he went to kind of help him out. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. Like, hey, you know, I did these things, and I think you might. And then I feel like Ferrari took offense to that, and that's how it escalated to, yeah, well, your cars are crap.
Yeah.
And
well, I mean, Enzo famously had a very big ego.
Mm-hmm.
Was you know, a narcissist. I wonder if the shoe was on the other foot.
Right.
If Ferrari came and was like, your tractors suck. Like, can you could switch this up? Would Lamborghini be as receptive as he thinks?
I have a feeling probably not.
Probably not. Yeah. These are some fiery Italian, you know, entrepreneurs coming out of post-war Italy. Like, they're just going to argue.
Lamborghini said, quote, this was the point when I finally decided to make a perfect car. After a showdown with Enzo, Ferruccio wasted no time in following through with his lofty threat to make a sports car that could rival Ferrari. Consider this. Ferrari is at the pinnacle of sports car manufacturing, with cutting-edge technology trickling down from their championship-winning motorsports team, and this tractor manufacturer has convinced himself that he has what it takes to make a better car. One thing Ferruccio knew he wanted to do differently than his new rival was to avoid the money pit that is high-level motorsports. Quote, I didn't care much about racing, said Lamborghini. I cared about building something better, something perfect. This was the last time Enzo ever said a word to Ferruccio. In May of 1963, Lamborghini opened a 12-acre manufacturing plant in the Santa Agata Bolognese and named it Automobili Ferruccio Lamborghini S.P.A. This plant is located between the cities of Modena and Bologna in a region of Italy known as Terra di Motori, or Engine Country.
It's funny that every country has like
Motown.
Motown, yeah. Or what was the Russian one where Lada was built? It was like Motori or something. Yeah.
It was named Engine Country because Maserati, Ducati, and Ferrari were all headquartered around the area. Ferruccio needed engineers, and lucky for him, he didn't have to look far, because it turned out that he wasn't the only guy that Enzo Ferrari had managed to piss off. Shortly after their infamous meeting, a group of Ferrari's most trusted designers and engineers, legends Giotto Bizzarini and Carlo Chiti among them, approached Enzo and told him that his wife Laura was getting too involved in his business affairs. It didn't take long for Enzo to decide who to support.
I actually know a Laura Ferrari.
Really?
Yeah, I was in an improv group with her for a long time.
Any relation?
No.
Oh. Enzo promptly fired all the engineers on the spot, which was some good fortune for Lamborghini. With a factory built and a stable of experienced mechanical minds on hand, Ferruccio...
Why don't you just stick to building tractors? You'll never be able to build a car. You don't have the right people. Here's the people. Not great, man.
Yeah.
Ferruccio just needed the right designer. With tons of brilliant designers in Italy at the time, the decision came down to pure vibes. Lamborghini said of Franco Scaglione, quote, he arrived at my place in a big shiny Mercedes, immaculately dressed and accompanied by a breathtakingly beautiful secretary. Quote, your car will be ready in a week, he told me, so I gave him the job. Scaglione penned the design for the GTV concept, while Giotto Bizzarini built the engine.
Dude, what a player. Just going to a job interview.
Yeah.
With some eye candy. Come on, dude.
I'm still on the guitar guys being turned on by Les Pauls.
Oh, look at the curves.
He got out of the Mercedes with a nice suit and a Les Paul on his shoulder.
Yeah.
Wow. He was John Bonamassa.
We'll be right back after these messages.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app, with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Now back to the show.
Bizzarini, who himself had worked on the Ferrari 250 GT, which was the catalyst for this entire situation, designed a 3.5-liter aluminum V12. It featured 4 valves per cylinder, 6 downdraft Weber carburetors, and a 4-cam design, which is a poke at Ferrari's single overhead cam per bank. The prototype engine Bizzarini developed can make 400 horsepower and rev to a staggering 11,000 RPM.
Holy shit.
In the 60s.
So, okay, I'm stuck on the overhead cam thing.
Okay.
Explain to me like I'm a huge dumb idiot. Okay. Why couldn't you just have more lobes on a single overhead cam instead of having two different cams controlling the rockers? You know what I'm saying?
I don't know this engine, but you can also have more exhaust port. Your exhaust valve and your intake valve, you can have two of each. I don't know if that's what he
did. That's what I'm assuming, that there's a two intake,
yeah,
two exhaust.
Four valves per
right
cylinder.
So then the cams that are controlling the valves going up and down,
mm-hmm,
why do you need two cams? It just to take pressure off of one cam?
Well, because you've got an intake valve and the exhaust valve,
yep,
that are alternating. So if you have two cams.
So what is
it's to make use of the room of the head, because you've got the holes in it for the cams.
So
if you've got the exhaust, you can have an intake and exhaust valve on the same side. You could have an intake and an exhaust, and then on the other side you could have an intake and an exhaust. You could also change it up and just do
exhaust on one
exhaust
side,
on, yes,
intake on the other.
But it gives you those more options so that you can get more airflow, and you can use different timing depending on which cams,
okay,
you want to end.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
It also,
I mean, depending on which valves, I don't know.
Yeah. If you were to have one overhead cam and still 4 valves per cylinder, it would kind of limit you because you'd have to put them pretty close
they'd be
together.
Like that, you, yeah, know what I mean? So why, so you wouldn't do it? Because
you can right, put them further apart or like play with the spacing if you need right to. Okay. I get it.
A single cam runs down to do push rods.
Yes.
Right. And so you're pushing up on different sides to push down the valves.
Yeah.
The evolution of that was like, well, we're going to do overhead cams, so we don't have to use a single cam with, yeah, push rods. So now you don't have push rods, so there's less to fail. And so all Ferrari did was take that idea and say, we can use more valves now. So
okay,
now we have double overhead cam.
Lamborghini said that.
Yes, sorry. Yeah. Lamborghini said, we can evolve that to have double overhead.
Okay, so Lamborghini just improved on Ferrari's design.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, literally, because it was, yeah, the same designers that,
right,
worked,
yes,
at Ferrari. Yeah,
yeah.
So they're like, oh, you got a pretty good idea. Like, mm-hmm, let's keep going with that. Let's follow that.
Yeah.
And improve upon.
That's cool that they were able to recognize that and be like, oh, this is, because Bizzarini like was the one who developed the Ferrari engine.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wouldn't even be surprised if Ferrari was like, stop, this is good, you know? And like, if, like we have an engine, so we're going to use this engine. And I have the sense that that's the kind of boss he was.
Well, yes, he was. Cause he was a guy that would pit people against each other all the time. And I wonder if he was like, look, like we have our racing team. They have their racing engine and like,
that's what
they know what they're doing. They haven't come up with this. So like your idea isn't right now. Of course, I don't know if that
this is all conjecture.
It's all conjecture, but it wouldn't surprise me anyway.
And in terms of a racing people, engine, there's more to fail.
Yeah.
So maybe he was like, this is the solution. We're sticking with it because
something I do all the time is like, yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. And then my brain just says, well, that's how it happened.
But 400 horsepower from an aluminum V12 back in the 60s is
crazy. That's a lot. The Lamborghini 350 GTV debuted in October of 1963 at the Turin Auto Show, merely months after the argument with Ferrari. After the initial...
That's a crazy turnaround. Yeah. That dude must have been heated.
After the initial reception, the body design was slightly tweaked and the engine was detuned for better reliability. The 350 GT, as it was now called, made 280 horsepower. 0 to 60 came in 6.4 seconds, easily on par with other luxury sports cars of the time. However, the true victory of this maiden model was its smooth handling and eye-catching design. It really is, I think, stunning. It's sick. It looks like something that Mr. Incredible would drive. Lamborghini was able to achieve such a stunning design of the 350 GT with aluminum alloy panels that were mounted directly onto the curvy tube frame body, which meant the chassis was still very light, but also very rigid. The 350 GT was the first car to feature the famous Lamborghini bull logo, which comes from Ferruccio's astrological star sign, Taurus. Quote, with the 350 GT, I wanted to show Ferrari that you don't need to be uncomfortable to go fast, said Ferruccio.
Wow.
Yeah, he said, he must be a Scorpio.
The car was a success. 120 units were sold over the next 2 years.
Such a Taurus thing to say.
Which might not sound like a lot, but for a company who'd never built a luxury sports car before, it was fantastic. The 350 GT established Lamborghini as an exciting new addition to the world of grand touring cars. But more importantly, it inspired Ferruccio and his team to continue to push the limits of design and engineering on their next model.
Hell yeah.
Which is, any guesses?
I mean, I read the script, so.
Okay, well.
Bart, though, Bart can guess.
I don't know the timeline.
Well, you're going to know.
Please.
You're going to know. On the heels of their successful debut, Lamborghini wanted to make an even bigger splash with their second showing. To further improve balance and handling on the road, chief engineer Gianpaolo Dallara dreamed of building a Formula One-inspired mid-engine supercar.
Mid-engine. I didn't know that Dallara did it, too.
Either.
Dallara famously made chassis for Formula One.
They make a lot of chassis still.
Yeah.
For a lot of spec racing series. The problem was that Ferruccio didn't think a mid-engine car was practical for road use. However, the ambitious young team worked on the chassis in secret and eventually presented Ferruccio with a near-complete rolling prototype.
What's the Italian word for skunk?
I don't know. What'd your grandmother say?
Skunku.
Skunku.
After a few moments of eager anticipation, he gave them the go-ahead to build the prototype.
Which,
he said,
again,
fine. Build it, but make sure it works.
Nice.
I feel like it's a difference of leaning on people, pitting them against each other, or understanding what you want and how to allow the people who know how to do it to give it to you.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You know.
Trust your crew.
Yeah.
Designed by 20...
And also don't fucking worry about race cars, because that's only
good. Yeah.
Designed by 27-year-old Marcello Gandini, the Mura... Named
I was going to say the Mura.
Named after the famous Spanish fighting bull breeder Don Eduardo Mura, was ultra sleek. It had pop-up headlights and a unique low-profile stance. Yeah, this guy makes the bulls f***. Name the cars after him.
It's not, yeah. There's this like...
it's not easy.
Romantic view that he names them all after like fighting bulls, but it's just like a guy that owned a bull.
Yeah. He makes them bang.
He puts on that big plastic glove.
when the P400, as the car was called at the time, unveiled in Geneva in 1966, the car made an immediate impact. Its stunning design and stated performance stole the show, and orders poured in before production even began. Quote, "The Miura shocked the world," said automotive historian Carl Ludvigsen. "It made Lamborghini a serious name overnight." The funny thing was, though, Lamborghini didn't even have a finished car. The one displayed at the show was assembled just days before.
Yeah.
When they placed a prototype body on a rolling chassis. Despite the last-minute shenanigans, the Miura changed everything, and today is seen as being the first supercar ever. As Jeremy Clarkson said, quote, "The Miura is not just a car. It's a turning point." After the Miura's success, Lamborghini doubled down on research and development and appointed Paolo Stenzani as technical director in 1968. Stenzani's first model was the Espada, a V12 four-seater GT car, and the Urama, another front-engine GT. However, these projects strained Lamborghini's finances, and they needed a new Halo model to generate excitement and showcase some new technology.
Yeah, those are like the two models that no one even really.
I like
the Urama. Ever been in a Miura?
No,
seen
no.
I've
James
seen
rode
one,
in one.
Yeah, that guy. I mean, that was a while ago.
That was like early.
He took me for a spin.
Was it cool?
It was. Yeah. But it's crazy to get into.
Is it tiny?
It looks amazing. Like you see it in person, you're like, oh yeah. Man! And especially if you put yourself in the shoes of someone when it debuted.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it's just very difficult to like get in. Once you're in there, it's comfortable, but you're almost like lying down.
Oh, wow.
So low.
Wow.
It was pretty cool.
It is like fairly close to the dimensions of that like Lancia Stratos Zero.
Yeah.
Not
dimensions,
the,
but like the. Oh, wait.
Yeah, I would say this. Not the Zero, the Stratos production car.
Yeah.
Looks very similar.
Mm hmm.
And it just seemed like you have to like lay down on it to actually drive it.
I think the craziest thing about that car is that the engine is mounted sideways.
Oh, it's like transverse?
Transverse mounted V12.
That's crazy.
Yeah, really weird. But that's how they made it fit.
Yeah.
By the early 1970s, automotive technology had caught up with the Lamborghini Miura. Sure, it was beautiful, but it had its downsides. You had poor rear visibility, unstable high-speed handling, and a very hot and tight cabin. Ferruccio wanted the next car to be more stable and comfortable, but also radical and completely futuristic. So work began on Project LP-112. Unlike the Miura's transverse V12, the LP-112 featured a longitudinally mounted V12 positioned ahead of the rear axle. It also had a unique gearbox placement in front of the engine, with a drive shaft running back through the oil pan, which allowed for better weight distribution and a shorter wheelbase.
That's crazy. So it's, you got the engine, this is not transverse, this is longitudinally mounted.
Yeah.
And then the gearbox, it's a rear mid engine.
Mm-hmm.
The gearbox is in front of it,
mm-hmm.
going to, I would imagine, a stick shift.
Probably.
And then the drive shaft goes back through the oil pan.
Yeah.
That's really
weird.
Wild. I would imagine there's some sort of loss of power if you're just kind of snaking it back.
Maybe. That's very interesting, though. I did not know that about this car. I mean, I don't know what this car is. Once again, Lamborghini called upon Marcello Gandini to design this futuristic machine. His design would go on to be Lamborghini's signature shape across all their future models. The concept was stunning. It had a radical wedge shape with an ultra-low stance and sharp angles, and was the first Lamborghini to feature scissor doors. The prototype, called the Countach LP500, premiered at the 1971 Geneva Motor Show to a completely stunned crowd. Road and Track said, quote, "It looks like it could fly and sounds like it already has. The Countach is more than a car. It's a declaration of war on the ordinary."
I'm actually not really sure what a plane looks like anymore.
Motor Trend said, quote, "Holy shit, what the fuck is that?"
They're like, "Oh, you speak Italian."
Marcello Gandini said, quote, "We worked at night and we were all tired, so we would joke around to keep our morale up. There was a profiler working with us, and he performed all the little jobs. He spoke almost only Piedmontese. One of his most frequent exclamations was Countach, which literally means plague, contagion, and is actually used more to express amazement or even admiration. Like, goodness, he had this habit."
Like Tabarnak.
Yeah. It's hilarious that there's just a bunch of dudes working on this car, screwing around. One of them's, and they just like keep saying Countach.
Yeah.
Why don't we just call it that?
That's pretty good.
It is a good, yeah.
Despite all the excitement, Lamborghini still had a problem. They had to make a usable production model of the Countach, a process that took years because a number of changes the design team was forced to make. The prototype's aluminum monocoque was swapped with a steel space frame, NACA ducts were reshaped, and the design bulked up for durability. Cooling issues forced the addition of massive side air intakes, and a periscope-style rear-view slot was added to improve visibility.
What?
That's sick. These timely, expensive changes placed immense financial strain on Lamborghini, stress which would only get worse in the coming years. In the early 1970s, volatile markets and numerous wars significantly changed the global landscape. Everything from gas prices to manufacturing capabilities were negatively affected, and the oil crisis of 1973 categorically rocked Lamborghini's already precarious financial situation. In the midst of the chaos, Ferruccio sold 51% of the company to Swiss businessman Georges Henri Rossetti. Rossetti took over, and the production version of the Countach...
Probably Georges Henri.
Georges Henri, you're probably right. There's an S at the end of George here.
Georges Henri Rossetti.
Yeah, Georges Henri. Georges Henri Rossetti took over, and the production version of the Countach was finally released in 1974, featuring essentially just a bored-out version of their previous V12. Now at 4 liters, it made 370 horsepower. With a curb weight of around 3,000 pounds, this car was incredibly ahead of its time. However, being iconic doesn't guarantee financial success. Even though the Countach sold well, there are only 157 units initially produced, and the company wasn't set up for a shift to mass production. All those years of R&D had paid off in terms of their final product, but the time and money they sacrificed basically offset the financial gains the Countach brought in. By late 1974, Ferruccio Lamborghini found himself completely disillusioned with the automotive industry and decided to sell his remaining shares. Quote, "I was tired of the car business. I wanted to return to my roots, to my land, to my vineyards. I had nothing more to prove."
And then I killed Enzo Ferrari.
After Ferruccio's departure, Lamborghini went through a litany of managerial changes and more financial difficulties. Georges Henri Rossetti failed to right the ship, and by 1978, Lamborghini filed for bankruptcy. Fortunately, in 1981, two Swiss brothers, Jean-Claude and Patrick Mimran, swooped in and bought the brand. To keep the company afloat, the Mimran brothers decided to limit new models and instead release new and improved versions of the Countach. It's pretty sound logic.
Yep.
Yeah. You did all the R&D, just stick with it. I mean, we haven't said this yet, but like they basically used the same version of this V12
for a very long time.
Yeah. For so long. Mm-hmm. And they just kept bumping up the displacement, making it more reliable.
Adding feature, you know.
Yeah.
It's not like it was modernizing. Yeah. Yeah.
But the same basic principle went into most of these engines.
It's like a Chevy small block.
We'll be right back after these messages.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Now back to the show.
The LP500S, which featured a bigger 4.8-liter V12, was released in 1982, followed by the 450-horsepower LP5000 Quattro Vivoli in 1985, which bumped displacement up to 5.2 liters. All the while, the Countach started to look more and more like a spaceship, first with fender flares, then a big wing.
Oh, that wing.
The wing's sick. And then there's like the 25th anniversary edition.
These versions of the Countach helped Lamborghini explode onto the pop culture scene in the 1980s. Appearances in movies and TV shows like Miami Vice captured the imagination of teenage boys and uber-rich car collectors alike. Outside of the Countach, Lambo's most bonkers release of the 1980s was something entirely different but equally shocking. Originally designed as a military prototype, the LM002 was a luxury off-road SUV powered by a Countach 5.2-liter V12. The Rambo Lambo, as it came to be nicknamed, was genuinely obscene. The 6,000-pound behemoth boasted 444 horsepower and can go 0 to 60 in 7.8 seconds. The interior was fully leather and had particularly strong air conditioning, which came in handy for customers like the Saudi royal family and Saddam Hussein's son, Uday. But even if Lamborghini was still making eye-catching vehicles, their accounting was still a mess. In 1987, the Mimran brothers decided enough was enough and sold Lamborghini to the Chrysler Corporation, who welcomed the Italians with open arms. Quote, "We're not here to Americanize Lamborghini," said Lee Iacocca. "We're here to unleash it." That's just, that's so, why does Chrysler talk like that? You know, like, it makes, now this makes a lot of sense. Like, if Kaniskis and like the other Dodge leadership, yeah, like they're just, I think they're just trying to be Iacocca.
Yeah.
It sounds like.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah. Like, cause you have to talk like a
we're
salesman.
Not here, our new Charger isn't here to restrain you with its EV. It's meant to
unleash you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I can totally
electrify
see that.
Your yeah. senses. They just have to talk like.
It's not a mandate for electric. It's a mandate for freedom.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. After releasing the Countach 25th Anniversary Edition in 1988, Chrysler began on its successor, Project 132, which would go on to be the Lamborghini Diablo. Released in January of 1990, the Diablo stayed true to the brand's signature scissor doors and V12 engine, but featured smoother styling and a larger cabin. Though more refined than the Countach, the Diablo still had incredible power. Its 5.7-liter V12 produced 492 horsepower, and made the Diablo the first Lamborghini to break 200 miles per hour.
Nice. The Countach, I think, is the cassette tape to the Diablo's compact disc.
That's really good. The nice. Diablo VT version, released in 1993, introduced all-wheel drive to a road-going Lamborghini for the first time. Despite plenty of buzz about the Diablo, Chrysler didn't think Lamborghini was growing fast enough to justify long-term investment, so they sold the company to an Indonesian investment group called Megatech in 1994. That's such a 90s
yeah.
name.
Yeah, that's like a from a 90s movie.
Yeah.
Like,
you name your company just some arbitrary
yeah.
name. Or like, and then be like, well,
the
what
family
do you guys
business
do?
Is going to be sold to Megatech. We can't.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
The gang at Megatech decided to lean into the Diablo platform, producing a number of variants throughout the 90s.
And adding quite a bit of tech.
A more lightweight
amount of tech.
A more lightweight and powerful version came in 1994 with the Diablo SE30. And in 1995, the Diablo SV featured a rear-wheel drive version that prioritized raw power over comfort.
And this one has a really cool, like, script
yeah.
Yeah.
on the side.
Super sick.
Love it.
Like on a Dixie paper cup with the...
Does that stand for soup of aloche or anything like that? Probably.
Spaghetti vongole.
Okay. A convertible VT Roadster also appeared that year alongside race-specific versions like the SVR, built for a one-make racing series. Late in the 90s, Lamborghini introduced Lamborghini introduced more extreme versions like the Diablo GT, a track-focused road car with 575 horsepower and advanced aerodynamics. Even though the Diablo was a success, Megatech continued to lose money. It was producing only a few hundred cars a year, and development costs for future models were becoming unsustainable. To make matters worse, the 1997 Asian financial crisis devastated Indonesia's economy. Megatech faced pressure to offload foreign assets like Lamborghini to shore up losses, and in 1998 decided to sell Lamborghini to Audi. Audi's takeover was a game changer. For the brand.
Game changer.
Game changer.
Like the Schick Gillette 3.
Three blades?
Audi and their parent company, Volkswagen, provided the financial stability, engineering expertise, and production discipline that Lambo had lacked basically since its inception. The first Audi-influenced Lambo was the Diablo VT 6.0. Released in 2000, the VT6 was engineered with a focus on improved build quality and refined styling. which showcased a new era for the brand. Though the Diablo was Lamborghini's only model throughout the entire decade, its many iterations kept it fresh and competitive.
It's like a sea urchin going into my ear whenever you say that.
And now with Audi firmly in control.
Sea urchins don't do that.
And with Audi firmly now in control, a strong foundation was set for the next generation. In 2001, Lamborghini launched its first all-new model under Audi, the Murcielago, with scissor doors, wedge design, and namesake derived from another legendary Spanish fighting bull. It was still very much a Lamborghini, but also more reliable and well-built than its predecessors. Powered by a 6.2-liter V12 producing 572 horsepower, the Murcielago was fast but surprisingly stable and user-friendly, and proved that Lamborghini was maturing under Audi leadership. The real statement came in 2003 with the introduction of the Gallardo. Available in all-wheel drive or rear-wheel drive, coupe or spider formats, gated manual, or with paddle shifters, the Gallardo also offered a more practical 5-liter V10 and was priced far lower than the Murcielago. As a result, the Gallardo became the best-selling Lamborghini at the time, with special editions like the Superleggera and LP564 keeping the model fresh until the end of its production run in 2013.
That's later than I thought.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the Murcielago evolved into the LP640 in 2006 and the 670 horsepower SV in 2009. I think Top Gear made a segment with one of these things out in Dubai somewhere with like one of those orange car. Very, very cool. I think that's just the sickest thing
like,
ever.
Man, the chocolate here is so good. It's got like phyllo dough and pistachio.
During this time, Lamborghini became a legitimate competitor to Ferrari, and appearances in movies like the Fast and the Furious franchise and the Batman trilogy only increased Lambo's global popularity. After the success of the Gallardo and the Murcielago, Lamborghini unveiled the Aventador in 2011. Featuring a new 6.5-liter V12 producing 690 horsepower, the Aventador, named after another famous fighting bull, had a carbon fiber monocoque chassis and debuted Lamborghini's now signature hexagonal design pattern.
This is like Aventador sounds like a cool bull thing, yeah. Bull related thing, you know.
Yes.
What is the bullfighter called?
The Matador.
Matador. It kind of sounds like Matador. Ferrari should come out with a car called the Matador.
Ooh. That's the guy who gets gored.
Not if he wins.
He's just good at avoiding other cars.
And then he stabs the hump, and then everyone cheers.
To replace the Gallardo as its V10 entry model, the company released the Huracan in 2014. With a dual-clutch transmission, advanced electronics, and refined driving dynamics, the Huracan was even more driver-friendly than the Gallardo, but still scary fast. High-performance versions like the Huracan Performante pushed the car to Nürburgring lap records. Together, the Aventador and Huracan brought Lamborghini into a new golden age of high-performance road cars and gave the company even more freedom to push the boundaries of design and power. By the time 2018 rolled around, SUVs had become one of the most popular car types for at least 20 years. Porsche had proven with the Cayenne that a luxury SUV could be a cash cow without sacrificing brand integrity. We talked about that a couple weeks ago in our Porsche series.
They pulled it off flawlessly.
Yes. Though purists scoffed at the idea initially, Lamborghini decided to develop their first ever SUV, the Urus. Powered by a 641 horsepower twin turbo V8, this crossover SUV combined Lamborghini performance with Audi tech and luxury. 0 to 60 comes in 3.5 seconds, and it handles like a sports car, but it also has room for up to 5 people.
This is a fun car.
Maserati has their SUV.
The toenail?
Yeah. But it, like there's other, you know, this level supercar SUV, and like none of them come close to the Urus.
I think the Purosangue is pretty close, and the red is amazing.
But the reason I'm saying is for the handling of it.
Oh yeah,
I don't drive it the way I would have to know this.
Yeah.
But everybody says it feels like it is a Lamborghini. It doesn't feel like it's an SUV. It feels like it's a Lamborghini.
Wow.
Whereas the other ones are like, yeah, it feels like a nice SUV that can zip.
Lamborghini lent us a Urus a year and a half ago, I want to say.
A Urus ago.
About a Urus ago.
Yeah.
And I took it up to Stunt Road.
Yeah.
It was, I mean, dude, yeah, it hauls ass.
Feels like
it's really planted for an SUV.
Yeah.
And dude, also like driving to work and stuff, like you just feel, I'm not the target audience for that car, I think. I felt very.
But also people say that it snow, ice, rock, it actually does everything.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
Still feels like it's a track.
I would love to put some 34-inch tires on one of those things. Go out somewhere.
The hack is to get an RSQ8 because it's a basically the same car for like $120,000 less.
Is it really that much less?
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh yeah. Wow. Like I think the RSQ8 is a little above 150, but then like the Urus is like 300 or something.
Much like the Cayenne did for Porsche, the Urus was a massive commercial success and quickly became the brand's best-selling model. At the same time, Lamborghini began developing hybrid and electrified platforms. The Scion FKP37, which debuted in 2019, was the first hybrid Lamborghini. It was a limited production V12 hypercar with supercapacitor technology instead of a traditional lithium ion battery. So I think supercapacitors, they can hold energy, really big amounts of energy, but not for very long, right?
But they release them way faster than a normal battery.
Okay.
So you're draining it way quicker, but it's like more power.
Gotcha. Whereas but they can't
flux
store it.
Capacitor.
Right. But they can't like hold it for as long as a battery.
Yeah,
right?
I think so.
Okay.
It's like if you drink a ton of water all at once,
you gotta
go really quick.
Yeah.
If you just sip throughout your day, you're not gonna have to go till the end of it.
That's good.
Exactly.
Lamborghini had made it clear new technology would be embraced, but power would not be sacrificed. Proof of that promise came in 2022 when Lamborghini unveiled the Aventador's replacement, the Revuelto, with an even more extreme design, full of sharp angles, Y-shaped LED lighting, and exposed mechanicals, much like a streamer's office.
Yeah. Much like an E-boy's stream den.
Yeah, it even came with like
$50 headphone holder.
Yeah, it came with a headset with little cat ears on it.
I do like the headlights though, the Y-shaped.
Pretty sick.
Have you seen one of these in the wild yet?
Yeah.
I haven't. I'm surprised.
Oh,
I haven't.
In the wild, no.
Yeah.
Oh,
like you've seen
well,
it.
In the studio.
That wasn't the wild, though.
No, I know.
Mean, on the road.
Yeah.
Like, what I think is interesting is it's been now almost 3 years.
I know.
And you would think all the other Lamborghinis around here, you see them.
Yeah. Well, I have only seen one Scion, and it was
the XB. It's very boxy.
Sean Lee took us to like an auto detailing spot that is like super meticulous and very expensive.
Oh yeah.
Remember?
That was crazy, dude.
And there's a Scion there.
Yeah. Scion.
And
there's also like a Bugatti
Bolide.
Yeah.
Wow.
That was insane.
That was
and it was just in South Bay or something like that?
No, it was like Orange County.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, which makes sense. That's right. That was crazy, dude.
Yeah. But I remember that like army green matte paint was amazing.
It was. The Revuelto was Lamborghini's first step towards a fully electrified lineup, aiming for full hybridization by the end of this year and the first fully electric Lamborghini by 2028. I think Ferrari is having some issues with electrification because like the point of the Ferrari is the sound, right? Like, you know, Ferrari is so well known for their exhaust note. I don't know if Lamborghini will have as hard a time selling an EV to their customers. Mm-hmm. Like the thought of a Lamborghini purist in my head is not as strong as someone who's like a Ferrari purist.
No. It's for different things. It's for design, comfort,
exactly.
Handling,
looks. It's all about the
you
looks.
You want to turn heads.
Yeah. Like if Lamborghini, all they need to do is build something as like crazy as the Cybertruck in terms of looks, not like literally looking like a Cybertruck, but like, holy shit, that looks sick as hell.
A disruptor.
Lamborghini's one. They don't need to have an engine in that thing, whereas Ferrari, they're kind of in a tougher spot.
I don't really think there's like as hardcore of a Lamborghini purist.
I don't think so either.
When you talk about what is an identity of a company and going through this episode, the identity of Ferrari is tradition, right? Mm-hmm. Do what I said.
Through
this is
racing.
What we do.
Through racing.
And Lamborghini is, we are going to be on the cutting edge of design and performance.
Yeah.
Period. I'm actually.
And it keeps, and so like when people were like, a Lamborghini SUV, that's sacrilege. It's like, no, it's Lamborghini's always been like, we are the biggest and the best.
Yeah.
And we're going to do everything over the top. And what's more over the top than the Urus?
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, that is almost, that's innovation, cutting edge. So I think that part of the brand identity looks that just cutting edge, period.
Yeah.
I don't think they're going to have, to your point,
and
a
they also,
difficult time selling and making it still be a Lamborghini.
The idea of a really insane looking Lamborghini SUV is very exciting to me.
Yeah. And they've already done it in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And people were like, whoa, that's crazy, but I love it. You know, like, and people still talk about the Rambo Lambo, even though it was just like basically a military
and
vehicle.
And a sales
flop. Yeah, yeah, never. It, what, they sell like 10 of them or something?
They're not many. Yeah. Wow, very cool. Yeah, because anyway, it's
no, I agree. To your point about the having difficulty, because it's not a true Ferrari, it's not a true whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't think you get to say that with Lamborghini,
because if it's different,
because it's
it
always
is Lamborghini.
Exactly. Yeah.
Wow, that's cool.
That is.
That's
cool.
Really cool.
It makes it more, way more free.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When James and Jesse went to Italy to go visit the Lamborghini factory, they came back and like kind of described it as like it. I mean, obviously, it's a fully fledged manufacturing plant, but the attitude there was more of like a tuner or like hot rod shop where they're like,
well, it's also when you pick your car, you pick everything, wheels, interior, fabric, leather. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess they use, I forget, it's a fake leather that they say is
rich
even
Corinthian
better than
leather. Yes.
But it's even better. It's a fake leather that's better than real leather.
While it began as a rebellious upstart, Lamborghini is now one of the most profitable and culturally influential supercar brands on the planet. Over 10,000 cars are sold annually, and the Urus SUV has doubled global sales since its release in 2018. That's impressive. From the humble vineyards of Ferruccio Lamborghini's youth to the stable Audi Volkswagen leadership today, Lamborghini's bold spaceship-like design has always set it apart from more conservative brands like Ferrari or McLaren. Lamborghini is more than a car maker. It's a cultural force that represents singular performance, extreme design, and unapologetic excess.
Nice.
Boom. There it is.
Lamborghinis.
Lamborghini, baby. That's the story. I'm so hype on Lamborghini now.
Yeah.
I want that Lamborghini EV in the lot. Yeah. Soon.
It's just such a different fundamental ethos from the beginning where it's like, this a cooler dude, you know, than Enzo Ferrari. He's trusting his team more. He's taking bigger swings and they're paying off.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think it's such a cool company.
All right. Thank you guys so much for listening. Follow Bart at Bids Bardo. Follow Joe at Joe G. Weber. Follow me at Nolan J. Sykes. Big thanks to our writer this week, Luke Klompien. And thanks to Edgar and Audrey behind the camera, always doing a wonderful job keeping us rolling here. At Past Gas, and thank you most of all for listening. We will see you next week. We're talking a guy named John Fitch. Don't know what that's about. Do you know what that's about?
Yeah. You know I read all these scripts.
I know you do. All right. Well, looking forward to that, finding out who John Fitch is. Should be a good one. So stick around. Thank you guys so much for listening. We'll see you next time.